Truth Revolution.
We are the best show in the cosmos.
Really? We are. I checked. I don't know, Dave. You'd have to make that claim. It's an extraordinary claim. You'd actually have to listen to all the other shows coming from other planets.
Right?
At other times.
I have.
Oh, all right. Just kidding. Since there is not life on other planets, that was pretty easy for you.
Yeah, we are Truth Revolution, where faith and reason meet. I am Pastor Dave, that's Pastor Jeff, and we are from Revolution Church in Kansas.
We would love for you to come out to Revolution Church.
You better.
Love to have you out here anytime. Doesn't matter what you wear. We just want you as you are. But hey, we got an announcement. We are going to a monthly instead of weekly broadcast. A monthly instead of weekly broadcast. So for the next few weeks, you'll hear us every week. Starting on April 1st, Easter, we're going to go to monthly. So you hear us the first Sunday of every month. And that's it. So you want to update your podcast settings and make sure you get automatically notified. If you're listening on the radio, you probably want to make sure you get the podcast. Right. So go to truthrevolution.tv. Check us out there so you don't miss any of our monthly podcasts going from here on out.
Right.
So
I wonder if maybe I should post something on the website that basically says something like that.
It probably wouldn't hurt. All right. Today we have a very special guest.
Right.
Because, we're going to talk about something that's pretty serious today. Something that's kind of been in the news lately.
Yeah.
Tell us who's on with us.
Well, we have astronomer Hugh Ross. He's the founder and president of Reasons to Believe, an organization that is dedicated to integrating scientific fact and biblical faith.
Yes. Welcome, Dr. Ross. Love to have you.
Well, thank you.
So it's always great to have you here. Now, today we're actually talking about Stephen Hawking a little bit, about one of the statements that he made before he died. We just actually got news that he died not too long ago. Now, before we get into what he said and what we're going to tackle there, everybody knows the name Stephen Hawking.
Right.
And I think most people know that he did a lot of work with black holes. Could you maybe give us just a little more information on what it was that he studied and kind of how he got famous or what his area of study in particular was?
Well, it goes back to his PhD thesis. He was interested in the singularities applied by Big Bang cosmology. And together with Roger Penrose in 1970, he published the first of the space-time theorems, which establishes that the universe has a beginning that includes the beginning of space and time itself. Hmm. A few years after that, he was interviewed by the Reader's Digest, where he said, "We prove that time is beginning. We prove that time was created," which actually implies there must be a causal agent beyond time that created our universe. Now, since that time, other physicists have taken his space-time theorem and extended it. Today, we've got about 30 different space-time theorems. But what's interesting, over the decades, those space-time theorems progressively more emphatically establish there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that created the universe. And I've written in a number of my books, that's significant because what's unique about the God of the Bible is that he claims to create the universe independent of space and time, rather than in space and time, like you see in the Eastern religions. So this is a huge step in establishing the Christian faith. The irony is that Stephen Hawking himself rejected the Christian faith, in spite of the fact that he was surrounded by peers who held to an evangelical Christian worldview.
Mm, that's right. And it was the Christian Post actually writes, in a video published by Popular Science last Friday, in which he was interviewed by popular astronomer Neil deGrasse Tyson, Hawking explained that he did not believe there was anything before the Big Bang, using a geographic analogy. And now I have a large quote from him. I want to go through some of that quote with you, if that's all right.
Sure.
But could you maybe give us just a little overview of what he's going to explain, and then we'll go through the quote and dissect it a little bit.
Well, what Hawking is doing, he's not alone. Other non-theistic physicists have done this as well, is they'll say it's not God that created the universe. It's something beyond our physics. And typically what they're doing is they're deifying nature. They're attributing to the universe characteristics that the Bible tells us that God and God alone possesses. So, for example, Hawking is reminding people in these last few weeks of a theorem, our paper he published with James Hartle more than three decades ago, in which he claims if we actually look at the universe as having not only a real dimension of time, but an imaginary dimension of time, we can eliminate the boundary condition of the universe, and therefore we don't have to have this beginning of matter, energy, space, and time. But he does admit in his best-selling book, Brief History of Time, that the attribution of imaginary time is pure speculation. He's putting that on the universe without any physical evidence that that is true. But the Bible is clear. The universe and everything in it is constrained to linear time. Only God has got access to geometric time. Hmm. But Romans 1 tells us that it's the property of people who rebel against God's authority over their lives to attribute to nature characteristics that alone belong to God. And I'm amazed as an astrophysicist how sophisticated some of today's leading scientists can be in attributing these characteristics of the divine to the realm of nature in a way that lay people simply don't notice what's going on.
Hmm. Okay, so a couple of things there to ask about. First, would you classify Hawking's as a metaphysical naturalist?
Well, I write about him in chapter 12 of The Creator and the Cosmos. Now, we just came out with an update 10 days ago where I kind of give the latest on his spiritual state, making the point that when he wrote A Brief History of Time, he was promoting a deistic worldview. But his later writings, he's moved from deism to atheism. And I think, you know, he's come under the influence of some peers that take a non-theistic perspective. And I think they've influenced him to move to a completely atheistic worldview. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, I just wrote a little piece on Facebook literally 10 minutes before showing up on this show. Because, you know, last night he passed away. And so I wrote a little piece on his life where I kind of comment on his spiritual journey and how interesting it is the contact he had with believers over the course of his life. Mm. But his real issue was what he wrote in A Brief History of Time, where he says, "My goal in life is to gain the mind of God, to know what God knows. And I mean, not just the physics that God knows, but everything that God knows, including the past and the future." Mm-hmm. And when I read that, when the book came out in 1988, I said, this is scary, because this is the temptation that Satan brings upon every human being.
Yes.
You can be like God. And I'm wondering if that's what really caused him to make that shift away from deism to atheism.
Fascinating. I did not know that. I'm going to have to check out that Facebook post. Now, let's get back into kind of what he said. You talked about, and he talked about, imaginary time. Well, now, I know some people are on their own time.
Right.
But
like me.
But what is imaginary time?
Well, I mean, this is a problem because most lay people I've never heard of, complex variables. That's a course you take as a math student when you're a sophomore or junior. And this is where you get introduced to imaginary mathematics, mm-hmm. Basically based on the square root of minus one. But the bottom line is it's the equivalent to attaching a second independent dimension of time to the universe. So time would no longer behave in a linear way. It would behave in a geometric way. And of course, that would make all the behavior of the universe radically different than what it is.
So when time is in a geometric shape, what does that mean about how we're able to interact with it?
Well, think of two dimensions of space, where you got a dimension of length and a dimension of width, where you could have things happening in a plane. Well, likewise, imaginary time allows you to think of time as not simply a line, but as a plane. And in a plane of time, you can have an infinite number of timelines running in an infinite number of directions. And I point out in my book, The Creator and the Cosmos, if you've got access to a plane of time, then in the timeline of this universe, you have no beginning, you have no ending, you are not created. Yeah, I argue everything in the universe, including the universe, must be created because it's constrained to linear time. But an entity that's not constrained to linear time wouldn't have that imposition. But notice in the Bible, it says that God and God alone has no beginning and no ending and is not created. He is the author of time. He created the cosmic time dimension. Therefore, he's not subject to time. But it also tells us in the Bible he's immanent. He's not only transcendent to everything he creates, he fills everything he creates, creates space-time dimensions at will, and remove them at will. Mm. So he can do all these things, but the universe can't. And that's kind of what Hawking was doing. By putting this imaginary time attribute in the universe, he was actually enabling the universe to be something that it is not.
And some people are going to say, well, it's called imaginary. Doesn't that mean by definition that he knows it's not real? And that's not what that word means.
It's not what that word means.
It's kind of like using the word theory in scientific theory. It doesn't mean it's just a concept that someone's playing around with, right? What is the word imaginary? Give a definition for that.
Well, it means something different in mathematics. In fact, I took a whole 2-semester course on imaginary mathematics. And it's not imaginary at all. It's real. In the sense that we discover is that by invoking an imaginary component to a real mathematics, the mathematics actually gets simpler to solve problems that have bearing in reality. I mean, to give you an example, in radio astronomy, we invent 2 more dimensions of space. So we have X, Y, and Z, and we call the other 2 dimensions U and V. And we discovered that by doing our mathematics in 5 dimensions of space, it's actually easier than trying to do it in 3. Then we translate from the 5 back to 3, and we get this beautiful map at radio wavelengths of a galaxy structure. And so we're actually able to take advantage of what is, quote, imaginary to achieve solutions to problems that are real.
Okay. And how does that relate to imaginary time?
Well, what Hawking says, hey, just like in imaginary mathematics, we invoke these extra dimensions of space. Why don't we do that with time and see what happens? And so he wound up writing a famous research paper where he says, hey, if we do it in just the right way, we can eliminate the boundary conditions of the universe. Mm. Therefore, the universe has no beginning. And he says, if it has no beginning, what need do we have for God? And what he wasn't really saying there was no God, but he's saying we can push God out of the way from doing anything really important.
Yeah.
That's why I said that back in the 80s, he had a deistic worldview, but now he's actually saying, well, in the years before his death, he was writing atheistic worldview concepts. Yeah. And hey, as a scientist and as a pastor, I know a lot can happen when somebody realizes they're only hours away from death. Mm-hmm. It seems to be that moment when they realize, hey, nothing matters except my spiritual state and eternal destiny. And so I'm not putting it past the Holy Spirit that maybe Stephen Hawking did serious spiritual business with God in the last hours of his life. Right. But the truth is, we simply don't know. Mm-hmm. But he certainly had plenty of background information from the evangelical Christians in his life to know how to go about doing that kind of business.
Mm, that's good news. All right, let's get to his quote that you had in the video. He starts out and he says, nothing was around before the Big Bang. Now, I want to analyze that sentence there because when he says nothing was before, that word before is almost a misnomer if I understand it right. He's not saying there was a before and before there was nothing. He is actually talking about time being more infinite and circular. So the word before kind of doesn't really belong there. Is that right?
Yeah, the word before is a problem because if we're talking about a beginning of time, how can you talk about before in our time context? But also the word nothing is problematic. I tell lay people, whenever a physicist tells you that the universe came from nothing, always ask, what kind of nothing do you mean? And what I've discovered is, without exception, the kind of nothing that they're talking about is always something. In Stephen Hawking's case, it could be the law of gravity. Well, the law of gravity is not nothing. It's something. Mm. There's a famous book put out by the atheist physicist Lawrence Krauss of Arizona State University. Mm-hmm. And the title was A Universe from Nothing. And I wound up writing a review of that book. It's up on our reasons.org website, where I point out that the nothing he's referring to is something. In fact, there's 9 different kinds of nothing that physicists speak about. And I had fun once. I gave a sermon in a church where I talked about everything you want to know about nothing and described the 9 different definitions of nothing that physicists think created the universe. Every case, it's really something.
That is funny.
Example, they'll say, well, the universe came from the quantum space-time fluctuations. Well, yes, there is a lack of matter, there is a lack of energy, but you've got space-time fluctuations. And in theoretical physics, you can use those space-time fluctuations to make matter. So space-time fluctuations are not nothing.
Yeah. Okay, and that's really important for us to understand. Right. Of course, you talk about Lawrence Krauss there, another famous atheist scientist who is still alive at this point. Okay, let's get to the next part of this. He says, according to Einstein's general theory of relativity, space and time together form a space-time continuum, and which, you know, we as Christians would agree with that, right?
Right.
Okay. He says, which is not flat, but curved by the matter of and energy in it. It was always my understanding that philosophers, physicists, whoever, understood that matter and time were intrinsically linked. But Hawking is basically saying that's not the case. Is that what he's saying?
Well, it's not the case today.
Okay.
I mean, Hawking is right that you can't separate the time dimension of the universe from the space dimensions. They are linked. And so we physicists speak about the 4 space-time dimensions of the universe, mm-hmm. and refer to it as a continuum. So he's correct on all of that perspective. And what was the other point that you made about that?
That we have always thought that space and time were linked, that matter and time were linked together. To have one, you had to have the other.
Here's how they're linked. The universe, the Big Bang creation model tells us that the universe began with these space-time dimensions in an infinitely shrunken volume. Mm-hmm. But they're created dynamically. When God brought it into existence, he created it with the property of ongoing expansion. And so the universe begins with no matter and no energy, just space-time curvature. But the space-time curvature is extreme. And as universe expands, the curvature is released. The release of that space-time curvature produces energy, which later produces matter. Now, it's not reversible. You can't take the matter and energy of today and compress it to get space-time curvature. So that doesn't work. But from the beginning of the universe, you can take that space-time curvature and produce matter and energy. So there is a link, at least in one era of time, between matter, energy, space, and time.
Okay. And I think that's... That's what he goes on. He says, in the Euclidean approach, the history of the universe in a behaves like a fourth direction of space. Oh, sorry. In the Euclidean approach of history, the universe in imaginary time is a 4-dimensional curved surface, like a surface of the Earth, but with 2 more dimensions. And that's what you're talking about earlier. Jim Hartle and I proposed a no boundary condition. The boundary condition of the universe is that it has no boundary. Okay, what does he mean by that? The boundary condition is that it has no boundary.
Well, what he's doing is he's invoking imaginary time to eliminate a boundary at the beginning of the universe. But as I pointed out, he agrees that that is speculation. You know, the thing I point out in the Creator and the Cosmos is 100% of the empirical evidence, our observations and experiments, sustains that there's a beginning to the universe and a beginning of space and time. Mm. So physicists who argue otherwise are forced to appeal to non-empirical evidences, to speculation, or what Alan Guth at MIT says, speculation squared, to try to get around what we see in our experiments and observations. Mm. I think it's important philosophically to point out we need to make the decisions in our life based on what we can see and measure, based on the empirical evidence. Because there will always be non-empirical evidence to counter what we see. I mean, I'll give you an analogy. I've got a huge amount of empirical evidence that my wife of 40 years is a real human being.
Okay.
But I could appeal to non-empirical evidence to say, you know what, I've been fooled all these years. I mean, what I've been interacting with is just a very sophisticated hologram. And I could give you mathematics and physics to show you how that could be consistent. But none of that math and physics would be consistent with the observational and experimental evidence.
Mm.
And what the Bible tells us is that the more we learn about the record of nature, the more we discover, the more empirical evidence we build up, the stronger will become the case for the supernatural handiwork of God. And, you know, I've been putting out editions of The Creator and the Cosmos now for 25 years. This one we released 10 days ago is the fourth edition. And I tell people, get all four editions, because you can see how from one edition to the next, the evidence gets exponentially stronger based on the empirical evidence that indeed there must be a God beyond space and time that created our universe and designed it so that billions of us can come into a redemptive relationship with Jesus Christ. But one of the things I've done in this fourth edition, I've got a chapter on how to respond to the non-empirical arguments against the Christian faith. Because I think a lot of Christians are being bamboozled by these non-empirical approaches used by these people with PhDs and mathematics that people have never been exposed to. For example, complex variables. How many people do you know that are fluent in complex variables?
Only Dave.
What?
Because they're not, they don't really know what this imaginary time is all about or what it implies or the philosophical problems with.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. Hey, by the way, I did get a copy of the new version of The Creator and the Cosmos. Let's throw a picture of this of the cover up there on the screen.
This one, right?
Yeah, there we go. Hey, that one right there. Creator and the Cosmos. Man, great stuff, by the way. Every copy of this book, and I have multiple copies, multiple versions of it. All, so you are so right. The evidence just keeps piling on. But let me ask a question, because I don't want to just sit and say, okay, let's look at the empirical evidence. Flat earthers, aren't flat earthers the type of people who say we can only rely on empirical evidence? And when you look out, you know, the horizon's flat. And doesn't that lead to that sort of thinking when you reject abstract ideas?
Well, you need to look at all the empirical evidence. I mean, if you look at a place on Earth where it's super flat and you've got a lake, for example, it's large, what you'll notice is that the buildings on the other side, you can't see the bottom part of the building. You only see the top part of the building. And if the Earth was really flat, you'd be able to see the bottom part of the building as well as the top.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I tell the flat Earth people, actually look at all the empirical evidence. When was the last time you're in an airplane at 45,000 feet? If you're only at 20,000 feet, you look out the window of the airplane and it looks kind of flat. But if you're at 45,000 feet, you can easily see the spherical component of the horizon. They call the crow's nest effect. If you're up in the crow's nest of a sailing ship, you can see a greater distance than when you're on the deck of the sailing ship. And that's one reason why sailors, even hundreds of years ago, even in Columbus's time, knew the Earth had to be spherical because the guy in the crow's nest could see stuff that the people on the deck couldn't see. Or I tell people, when you're in an airplane flying, say, from Athens down to Johannesburg, you're going to cross the equator.
Yeah.
And if you do it at night, look out the window. You're going to see something really interesting. You'll see the constellations slowly turn upside down. That would never happen on a flat Earth.
What? Wait, are you serious?
This blew my mind.
Say, explain that in part again. Explain that again.
Well, I've actually been on an airplane several times crossing the equator. And yet, as an astronomer, I like to look out the window and see what happens to the constellations. Watching Orion, for example, turn completely upside down. Talk to your friends in Australia. They'll tell you all the constellations are upside down. Compared to what we see in the sky.
Interesting.
So there really is a down under.
I'm so confused right now. Okay, that's great.
Yes.
All right, hey, we're going to answer a Bible contradiction and get into a domain where I'm not so flipped out.
Bible contradiction.
All right, Bible Contradiction today brought to you by infidels.org. Did the women say something about Jesus' empty tomb, or did they not?
Okay.
Matthew 2:28-8 says, they went out quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to bring his disciples word.
Okay, so they went out, they told people quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mark 16:8 says, they said nothing to anyone and they were very afraid.
Okay. We use a cracked acronym to solve contradictions, mm-hmm. to interpret the Bible. And the very first C is?
Context.
Context. All you got to do to solve this is read the context. Okay, Mark chapter 16:8 is where it says they said nothing to anyone. Mm-hmm. But let's just read a couple more verses, okay? This is verses 8 to 11. Let's go ahead and read it, Dave.
Yeah, it says, they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now, when he arose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast 7 demons. She went and told those who had been with him, as they mourned and wept. And when they had heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they did not believe.
Okay, so she did say something, even in the book of Mark, where right. a couple of verses earlier it says they said nothing. In fact, it says, okay, she told those who had been with him, quote, those who were mm-hmm. with Jesus, which is exactly what Matthew 28 says happened. They went and told the disciples. So why would Mark, two verses earlier, say nothing, say they told nobody, when right. in fact she did go tell people? Well, okay, the A for author's intention. What was he trying to communicate here? Could you imagine any scenario in which you'd say they said nothing, then they told someone? Let's just imagine a military private was on guard duty at an army base.
Right.
He saw some soldiers planning a terrorist plot. He said nothing to anyone. He went straight to the general on the base and reported their plan.
But then he said something to someone.
See, and this is exactly right. what's coming across, right? It's pretty much exactly what the book of Mark said. The intention there is not to say you never say anyone to anything or anything to anyone. The intention is to say, generally speaking, they kept this information to themselves except for those people who needed to know. In fact, you just look back a few verses in Mark, verse 7 says, an angel said, go tell his disciples. Right. So it says, go tell his disciples. So they said nothing to anyone and went straight to the disciples.
Wow.
So this isn't nice. A contradiction. This is just clarifying who they were telling and who they weren't telling.
Right.
Hey, Dr. Ross, is there anything you want to add to that or about Bible contradictions in general?
Hey, you guys did a fantastic job on that. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Do you find, as a scientist, people bringing up scientific contradictions to you ever and solving those is interesting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I've seen them doing that in the Bible where they say, okay, Isaiah 40, it says God looks down the circle of the earth. Does that mean that the earth is flat?
Right.
And point out to them, hey, if you're above spherical body, it's going to look spherical or circular from all perspectives.
Yeah.
Right.
And actually, the Hebrew word there means circle or orb. It's got right. two different definitions.
Yeah.
It's actually a great text to take people to say, this is a Bible text in the book of Isaiah that shows that the earth is spherical.
Yeah. And it's funny, we just did a show about flat earth.
Right.
The Bible, what the Bible says about flat earth, around earth, just last week, I think it was. So we talk about how you also have to understand what the Bible's main point is. A lot of times the Bible uses language that our culture uses when it's not trying to be scientifically accurate. But that's the answer for our contradiction today.
Bible contradiction.
All right. So, you know, we're almost done here. Dr. Ross, we got another minute or so. What would you say the bottom line is when it comes to your book and what Hawking said? Okay. I mean, you basically already answered everything that Hawking brought up, didn't you?
Well, I did. But the bottom line is this. The more we learn theoretically about these space-time theorems, the more compelling those space-time theorems become that there must be a God beyond space and time that created everything. You know, another famous atheist physicist is Sean Carroll at Caltech. He published the quantum eternity theorem based on speculations that quantum space-time fluctuations when the universe was younger than 10 to the minus 43 seconds might have been big enough to avoid time beginning of the universe. But what's interesting is that some astronomers have come up with observations on distant quasar images that says that those quantum space-time fluctuations were as big as Sean Carroll says, those images would be blurry. Well, guess what? They're not blurry.
They're clear.
This prompted another physicist, Aaron Wall, who's a Christian theoretical physicist, He came up with a space-time theorem that says even if the quantum space-time fluctuations were quite large, we still have a beginning of time. So even in the last 2 years, the theoretical evidence has become much stronger. But what I predominantly do...
Well, actually, we only got like 3 seconds left. I'm going to have to cut you off there. We will link to all that at truthrevolution.tv.